we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to another episode of How Did It Make Sense, in which we start to look at the differences between those simple, linear, judgmental first stories, which are the ones that we often hear about. They're full of counterfactuals, they're full of blame, because they're incomplete and they allow us to use that fundamental attribution error or bias to come to a judgment. But that's not where the learning happens. The learning really happens when we dig into that second story, and it takes time for that to emerge because we need to understand the conflicts, the goals, and the tensions. Now, a lot of people think this is a sharp end issue, and some of the conversations we've had recently are slightly higher up, and that's why I've got Andy on here, who is a strategic person, and I want to hear his side of, you know, where do these first and second stories come in? So, Andy, who are you? What do you do? Where are you based? And where can people find you physically or virtually?
Well, hi. Yeah, I'm Andy. I can say that with some certainty. I'm based anywhere somebody wants to hire me, really, because I love working with people about change and so on. And geography largely doesn't matter anymore. I mean, I've actually just returned, as some may tell by my accent, to Scotland after 14 years of not living here. So I've lived in Africa for a while. I lived in the Netherlands for a few years, and then I shipped out to the Middle East and worked all over the GCC for a while. In between times, I've had, you know, trips to the Far East and the US, and I'm delighted to share stories at conferences. I think I've got something like 50 international events and keynotes, and I'm hosting a conference next month. There's a couple of awards under my belt as well, which I'm very, very proud of, but more proud of the change that we...
Yeah, that comes, that you create.
Yeah. So does that answer your question?
Well, so where do people find you virtually then?
Oh, LinkedIn, Andy Barker.
Okay, we'll provide a link to that. That's fine. That's cool. That's no worries at all.
Yeah, I think I like piggybacking on things that other people do. So there's like the Community for Human and Organization Learning, their YouTube channel. There's a couple of webinars I've done, a few conference recordings. Cool. HSE Global Network, they've had me on a couple of times with interviews and things like that. So yeah, other than that, www.orgtree.me. That's my own company.
I will put a link to that in the show notes, and people can find you virtually and then have other conversations. So, you know, this podcast is about first stories and second stories. So what's the first story that you've got to tell us? The first story of an event, not like two stories, that first interpretation of something that's happened.
Yeah, I think, so I believe if I can change how you think, then I can change how you behave. And I remember sitting in a very tough industry, in a very tough environment with a CEO who was probably the toughest guy that I'd ever had to work with, trying to change his thinking and see the value in other people and what they bring. And in the middle of the conversation, somebody came into his office and said, I need to tell you about an accident. Somebody's just lost their fingers because they put their hand inside a machine while it was operating, a compressor. The drive belt had jumped off. They grabbed the drive belt to put it back on and lost their fingers. So the CEO of this organization looked at me over the top of his glasses, feeling very much like teacher student here, and said, "How on earth can you convince me of anything different when somebody does something as stupid as that? There is no point in furthering this conversation." And I said,
Wow.
Give me 2 days and I'll come back to you with a better story. And he went, I'll give you a week.
Cool.
Therein is his confidence that I will not be able to change his mind.
Yeah.
So that's
excellent.
The first
story. So the first story. So what led, you know, what conditions led to that situation? And what was the narrative that you went back to the CEO? And I'm guessing because of the smiles on your face and, you know, you're generally a happy person anyway, is that you did convince him that there was more to it than being a stupid person who doesn't understand the risks that are involved in a high energy situation.
Yeah, so I believe, in fact, I've never looked at a first story like that and not been able to talk about patterns, culture, and strategy. And there is always a link. Everybody that does anything is a function of how they've been set up to do something.
Yeah.
I think the first story, very emotional, right? I think our brains tend to look at something and say, well, quickly, why is that not my fault? And how can I learn from that immediate situation? And it's like, oh, yeah, no, I didn't tell him to put his fingers in there and I won't do that. So you've got two answers. You walk away and, you know, it's very easy to say guy's an idiot. So I kind of know how organizations work, right? I've been very fortunate to sit at a board level of multiple companies over my time and see how people think in Africa and the Far East and the Middle East. And it's kind of the same. There's more about what makes it the same than different. So I think like all good safety people, you hang out and you talk to people and you figure out what normally happens here, what you're happy with and what do you think just happened. And then it came out that, you know, the construction manager running the construction job on which this compressor was located now had, you know, five people downtime because they couldn't use the jackhammer anymore. And what about other pieces of equipment? Well, yeah, it's all crap, right? All of this equipment's rubbish because, you know, we've hired a crap third party. So, well, why have we hired a crap third party? Well, you know, finance won't let procurement go to the supply chain and do anything other than get the cheapest one. So, well, what's the implication of the cheapest one? So, well, this guy isn't a technician. He's a laborer because that company won't hire technicians because they're expensive. So you've got one technician on site running around all of this equipment that's out of date and not maintained and there's no procedures for any of that. And he says the common faults are as follows, and this is how you deal with it. And he teaches the labourers how to flick a belt back on without taking hold of it so that the belt keeps going, right? Because if you switch it off, it's
lost
that rubbish.
Time.
You might not get it to start again. So you start building up a pattern and you say, why is it that we get to the situation where a company that behaves the way that it behaves, you don't know that before you engage them. So you talk to supply chain and say, right, did we visit the workshops? Did we visit the management? Did we look at a site where they operate? And it's like, no, sorry. A supplier qualification? What? Sorry? Because that's, what's the point in doing that? Because finance won't let us play. So then you go to
it costs you money to do a pre-qualification process.
To do that. And you're like, I pre-qualify, and I always say, I found this really good company in finance here, they're cheaper than the last guy. Well, no, they're more expensive. Well, you can't have them, right? Because they're a powerful organization. So you talk to finance, and you say, how did you help set operations up for success? They say, oh, we've got a penalty clause. You've got a penalty clause? What's a penalty clause? Well, if it costs 20 quid a day to hire a piece of equipment and it runs for 10 hours, if it's down for an hour, we charge them £2. And I said, how much does it cost to run the team? Well, I don't know. Well, imagine the penalty clause was linked
It's
to
got to be
downtime.
it's got to be meaningful.
It's got to be meaningful. So I said, just so happens the construction guy has given me some information you might find helpful. Look at the downtime that's a result of this. And then we bring procurement in and say, how can we generate uptime as a result of these? And now we're having a different conversation about the value that each of the operations, the construction guy, the maintenance guys, the procurement guy, and finance to say, well, is this a problem worth solving? Well, actually, it is. So then we come up with a whole different plan and a whole different strategy and a whole different way of thinking, because for the first time, they're not in a, am I allowed to say, pissing contest?
Yeah, you can do that. That's fine.
Is that okay?
That's
Okay,
okay.
they're
Piss
not.
pissing contest, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So that they no longer have adversarial relationships because they
Yeah,
can
that's it,
see
yeah.
how they can work together to fix a problem that they all agree is a problem. But the problem that they had before was my purpose is more important than yours, and saving money is more important than your efficiency. Saving money is more important than, you're getting a shiny supplier in with brand new equipment, right? Because we're here to make money, right? And we can't make money unless I make that decision for you. So I went back to the CEO and I said, guess what I found?
It's not what you think it is.
It's not what you think. Let me tell you how the infighting amongst your team at the management level, because neither will let the other do their job. Therefore, they're all in a huff with each other. So we've withdrawn collaboration from each other, which means, in effect, I know stuff I'm not going to tell you. And if you fail, it's on
I'm
you,
going to make
right?
sure you fail. Yeah, exactly.
Right? And exactly, if you're that far apart, you start undermining each other. You start undermining the policies and procedures that people get out. And who suffers as a result of that, right? So it's going to lead, if ill-informed decisions lead to bad outcomes. So if you can take a bad outcome and understand how to link the bad outcome with what's going on at a policy level, and you do that with patterns, you do it with, what else would be a symptom of those bad decisions, right? Where else would I see that? And instead of trying to transact the one event, you start
Yes,
looking to create
absolutely.
leadership, culture, and how do I take it back to the decision makers? So that
The
would be the
need to
second
be
step.
able to. No, that's really cool. And there's a couple of bits that come out of that for me. One is that many organizations have got business units that are in competition with each other. So not just standard departments, so ops or HR or logistics or procurement, but actually product parts of a business. And it might be business unit A that generates revenue, B, C, D, and E. And they've only got a finite amount of resource and they have to bid for those resources, which means they're now in competition with each other as opposed to collaboration. So you can end up undermining and bringing, we had somebody in a previous podcast talking about bringing in assets from outside, which may impact security clearances for an organization because they've gone to somebody that they probably shouldn't have done. But that's a good market to go into. So that was one thing is that. So how have you picked up on that and how have you managed to resolve those conflicts or tensions that exist?
I think so. I've been working on in the area of purpose, meaning, mastery, autonomy. The real what motivates us as a bunch of people, right? So if you haven't got purpose nailed, right, you really understand what you're here for and the contribution that you're trying to make to society, then you end up with a strategy that leads you to a slightly different place, right? So there's an example. What were the a bunch of people selling cameras, right? So you go out, they've got the blue team and the red team, and they're in competition with each other. And at the end of every month, right, your sales bonus is based on, did you beat the other team? So are you going to share secrets with the other team that would actually boost overall sales for the whole company, and you'd all be better off? No, you've actually incentivized bad behavior. You've actually incentivized behavior that are going to undermine each other. So a lot of, you know, when you're sitting at the top of the tree having a conversation with your people, what service do you provide humanity, people, the planet, society, whatever it is? And what's the best version of ourselves to be able to do that? And usually the best version of ourselves is how do you connect the brain power in your organization to that purpose and not competition with each other?
Yeah.
That leads to secrets and things. It's nonsense. I know it still goes on, right? But I think it's nonsense. And as soon as you start attaching monetary rewards, I am a huge believer in recognition, right? Recognition for who you are and what you bring. I just fought against bonus schemes because I haven't found one yet that incentivizes the right behavior.
The right behaviors. Bingo. Yeah. There you go. And actually that brings me on to the next piece. And we sort of touched on it earlier, is how do you go about finding those problems if you're inside the organization? And where I'm sort of going to is, you know, and it ties in nicely with what you've just said, is, you know, let's have a reporting system. Let's reward people for the observation cards and things like that. And my view is that drives the wrong behaviors if you don't have the culture. And where I'm going is, you know, the storytelling we were discussing before is, how do you find those stories if you don't have an external consultant says, hey, hang on, Mr. CEO, give us a couple of days, I'll find the answer for you. How do you find those internally?
I think there's a whole education piece. Are you comfortable with being controversial?
you mean to your guest or to me as the host?
Well,
that's what I do, but be controversial. That's what this is all about.
Yeah, so, you know, what you just said there is, you know, about the observation cards, right? And how do you find the right stories and things like that? It's the fundamental premise on what these things are built are, please tell us when it went wrong, okay? And our brains are fundamentally wired to, you know, the social rules, the rules of the tribe are protect people in the tribe and help the tribe out. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to articulate a bad thing just happened into, if I tell you about this, Gareth might get in trouble. There's a social risk associated with that. So
honor amongst thieves.
Honor amongst thieves, right? But it's we like to protect the tribe against social risk. You know, our brain can't tell the difference between imagined risk, social risk, and a broken leg, right? But we're very optimistic. So we'll think, I probably won't get a broken leg if I do this. But if I tell somebody I'm going to do it, I will be in trouble. It's harder to take a social risk than it is the risk of breaking a leg. So if you look at it this way, we choose the profession that we choose. And we like the profession we choose. We want to get better at the profession that we choose because that, in that way, we can contribute to the organization that we're a part of better. And along comes a safety guy and says, let me know where you get that wrong, will you? And I'm like, what? Sorry. No, but I'm doing good stuff here, right? Can we talk about that? I mean, if you want to talk about good things, well, there's no learning in that, right? Tell us about bad things. In fact, I'll tell you what. We've got these corporate procedures and corporate plans, and we've been, you know, planning the job that you're doing for 2 years. But you let power know where we get that wrong, will you?
Yeah, right?
Yeah. That's not going to happen, is it? So we think we've got an engagement problem that we think is a you thing, but it's not. It's a me thing, right?
Yeah.
I need to change the language so that I get more information about how we can be better versions of ourselves. So.
Yeah.
Where, you know, as you know, I teach storytelling, but if you look at a story, the construct of a story is, this might be a bit risky, but I'm going to go over the point of no return, find the trusted guide, I'm going to make a change in the world and a change in me at the same time, and the place that we arrive is better than when we started. So if you go around and say, can you tell me the challenges that you have just overcome. They'll say, yeah, this was in the way, but we had to shift it. And now the world's a better place, right? You say, thank you very much. And then you go and say, I just want to tell you about Gareth. Gareth found a problem, got some help, fixed it. We just want to say thank you very much to Gareth. And folk are like, oh, well, do we get thanked for fixing problems?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'll tell your story and we'll recognize it. And then we'll tell your boss that your boss is a good guy because he's obviously supporting you in getting problems solved. Now, fundamentally, when you look beneath the story, you see, yeah, that was in the way and we had to shift it. But what was in the way, safety people would call a hazard or a risk or an opportunity for improvement or a, you know, an observation, whatever it is, right? But if you use the language of contribution, then you connect and you collaborate and you create. If you use the language of catch and correct, they were like, yeah, jog on. Just, yeah, nothing to see here, keep walking. And it all gets hidden. Now, the more, like back to the first story, the more you hear about, what's the challenge you have to overcome? I need to keep this piece of equipment running while I flip the belt on. So let's figure out how we can fix that challenge and work out why we set you up like that, right? Now, if we do the catch and correct thing and go out and say, don't stick your fingers in that,
I haven't changed your productivity goals and I haven't changed what I'm going to reward you for.
Yeah.
So I'm going to leave it to you to manage that risk. Now, a lot of the time, you know, you've developed that tacit knowledge, that experience, but you haven't got a crystal ball. And so it's much easier and much more effective at scale to understand the system and change that as opposed to turning around to that individual and say, don't stick your hands in there. Yeah, but how am I going to solve that problem when you haven't changed the constraints in which I'm operating? And if I don't hit those targets, you're out. I will find somebody else who can.
And that's the thing. I think there's a lot of people don't recognize where power resides. And when you're abdicating responsibility for the power that you have for change. So, you know, when you... I'm going to give you a personal statement now. So my purpose is to have powerful people use their power to take care of those with none. And as soon as you say, here's everything that you've been given to get that job done, you let me know where I got that wrong, will you? No, not ever. So if you go around saying, okay, I'm a powerful person, but I am going to use the power that I've been given in the position that I have, the knowledge that I have.
Spider-Man, Peter Parker. There we go. With great power comes great responsibility.
There you go. And with great responsibility comes great power sometimes, you've got to figure out how to use it. So if you go out, right, what's life like you? And in fact, I'll tell you, I was invited to a site walk that turned out not to be a site walk on a construction site.
Sounds like a story there.
Well, there is. There's a bigger backstory for another time, but they'd put on this event, and the event had come from a story that I'd shared about this terrible event that somebody had put on, and they logged it and said, well, we're going to do a better version of that for you. So it's a lovely story. I showed up and there's 850 people with smiles on their faces going, look what we did, right?
Wow.
And apparently, because I have a job title, I'm a guest of honor, and the clients there, it's a construction site, clients there, the leadership team are there, and they're all smiling going, ah, look what we did. And I was overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed at what I saw in front of me. It was great. I was so pleased. And they said, okay, Andy, speech. You may have noticed I can talk. But
no, not for the 5 minute that turned into a 35 minute call we had the other day. No, not at all. But it was great.
So I had nothing, right? I had nothing prepared. I had nothing in my head. And you know, I was completely destabilized. And they said, Andy, speech, right? And there's 850 people smiling at me. wanting, you know, congratulations and recognition, and you know, they're very proud of what they've done. And I said, okay, I'm going to give you my version of leadership. If you do not have what you need to contribute in the way that you want to this organization in your role, then there is nobody in this organization to blame but me.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have it, it's because I haven't made it okay for you to ask for it.
Yeah.
So put me to the test. What do you need? And a Nepalese gentleman stood up and said...
Which in itself is something.
Oh, huge.
Yeah.
I'll send you the photograph, right? So this chap stood up and said, I've worn out my shovel. I need a new one. Can I have a new shovel? And one of my guys stepped forward and said, you know, it's okay to ask. And I was like, no, clearly not, right?
No.
Clearly not, right? And you and I will have a conversation about that.
Yeah.
And then I turned around and I said, can we get this gentleman a new shovel? The head of finance said he can have two tomorrow. And I said, interesting that you said that and not the construction manager. We can talk about that tomorrow. And I turned around and said, there you go, and have two. And he walked out and gave me a hug. And the conversation I had with the management team later on was, do you see how important it is to individuals to have the support they need, to be given what they need, to contribute in a way that makes them feel good about their contribution?
Yeah.
And where that goes. And do you see why what we've set up here, I don't have what I need. It's not okay to ask. Do you see how that's an us problem, not a them problem?
Yeah.
Engagement's never a them problem. It's always an us problem. So how good do you think that guy is going to be at digging holes tomorrow? How productive do you think that guy's going to be at digging holes tomorrow, right? And it was like, yeah, okay, Andy. No, I'm enjoying this. I can talk all day like this because you're getting a hard time for not using your power to help those who've done, right? But I feel a change coming, and it did.
Cool.
3 years, cool. 3 years later, that company, which was in Saudi Arabia, 3 years later, in June of this year, the management team were in London picking up an international safety award.
Cool.
Because once you figure out how you're supposed to treat people, it actually makes you feel good, and it actually has a business benefit.
Yeah.
And it's safe.
Absolutely. And it reminds me of something yesterday. So I was at a conference yesterday, and one of the presenters before me talked about how they brought in coaching contracts for students in a training system. And I read this and I went, this is all about them. Where's the instructor contract that mirrors this? And it was all about, this is your responsibility as a student to say, if it's not happy, you speak up. And I'm thinking, that is not how you create the confidence in there. And you know, I need to do some more digging and find out what the leadership development happens. What was quite interesting was that they'd offered coaching to the instructional staff in this organization, and none of the instructors took the coaching opportunities up. And it was like, that's interesting. And so, to, you know, when we talk about, that's something that's worth digging and finding out the story behind that.
Yeah, for sure.
So, you sort of, and I think part of the problem with a lot of these systems is you see a little nugget and you go, can I have the power? Do I have the power to challenge that person? So as an external consultant or somebody who's in a leadership position, you're right, you have that independence, but you've also got to have the integrity. So as a consultant, you can come in and sit there and go, can I be controversial? Can I ask the questions, or do I want some more business? And so it's that bit of, I have power because I am independent and it doesn't matter. I can walk away from this and I'm not going to lose my job as such. You know, I've got a goal that's here. But do I want to do this, the typical more work needed and here we go? Or do you want to create a change in the here and the now? And if you create that sort of nugget of truth that then grows and people go, you know what, we're going to keep you, Gareth. because you challenged us and we like the ideas. Or actually, we don't like you because you're challenging us. They're like, right, in that case, you're not my client.
That's a lot of ground there. I'll give you how I think. I'll give you how I behave. I'll give you how I interact with organizations. And challenge is a good thing. As long as individuals can see how I might be a part of the problem, but in addition, how I can be part of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you lay a path of blame to somebody's front door and then go, walk away, don't think you're going to get hired, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, I see the pain that you're having just now. I kind of know why that pain exists. And I'm gonna show you that the pain of change isn't as bad as the pain of staying here. And in fact, I'm going to take you either to a place of, you know, better performance and feeling better about that, or I'm going to help you avoid, mm-hmm. you know, bad outcomes, whichever way, it just depends. But I think human beings differentiate themselves from the animal world because of the ideas that we have in our head and our ability to collaborate around about mm-hmm. ideas. And we kind of go through life going, oh, the way that I think is okay. And, you know, we seek validation and I was right after all. And, you know, you tell hero stories. You know, what did you do at work today, Dad? Well, let me tell you.
Yeah.
So when I talk to people, I have to recognize that they're very proud of their achievement. They're doing what it is that they believe is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
There may be some adjustments that they haven't been exposed to, because consultants get exposed to lots of industries, lots of countries, lots of continents, lots of
ideas and practices.
Lots of ideas, fundamentally, right? So I think if you approach it along the lines of, I see what you're trying to achieve. I see the vehicle that you're using to try and get you there. And if we just tweak that a little bit, mm-hmm. it'll get you to the place that you're trying to go. To get over the change is hard.
Yeah.
Piece.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And also, if you've invested in a tool or a practice or a process or whatever it is, it's really, really hard to say, well, that didn't work. Let's walk away. I'm just going to go and tell the board, see those millions, right? You're going to stick at it and try and get it to work, right? So whilst not everything can be fixed, there's always a logical, great idea behind all of the, or theory behind all of the ideas that we have. It's understanding how to apply it in your context, in your language, in your way of doing business, in the context of your purpose, right?
Yeah.
So let's focus on what you're trying to achieve and then put the polish on it to get you there.
Mm-hmm. No, that's really, really good. And I think the bit where you said it took that company 3 years to go from what appeared to be a really, you know, sort of, you could tell that first story, you say, what? Then become very competent and award-winning, is that I think many organizations and individuals want, right, let's do something, and a couple of months' time, what's the results? Have we got anything that's changed? It's like, it's marginal gains, it's those incremental growths, and that's really hard to maintain your own drive, but also from the team's point of view, but it's always measure backwards was a quote that I got from, and I can't remember, a book, but just talking about the gap in the game.
I don't know about that. I look forward to seeing the link in the post.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I think measurement's really important, right? And I think measurement should be around about the change you're trying to create. I see, especially in the safety profession, we say, okay, can't measure accidents. What do we measure instead? Let's measure some transactions. Okay, mm-hmm. what are the transactions? Inspections, audits, pre-job briefs, risk assessments, actions completed on time. They don't tell you about anything creative other than you've created the paper mm-hmm. or the action, and then you close it out. So we don't know if we're doing dumb things fast and on time or great things late.
Yeah.
So the philosophy has to be, what's the change that we're trying to create, and how do we recognize that those changes are in place. So I measure capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I measure trust. And
so what is,
I,
so,
I measure
what is capacity?
Resilience.
Yeah. Talk about capacity, resilience, and trust. You know, trust is a fairly common one. Capacity and resilience. What do those mean? You know, to an organization at your level, as opposed to cognitive capacity or individual resilience, where we have sort of the sort of health and well-being stuff. So, because I'm guessing you're not operating at that level, you're operating at a much higher level.
Oh, absolutely. So if you take it, there's a piece I've given away already, because I'm pretty, a lot of people are trying to figure this stuff out, right? And I've figured it out, and I want to put food on the table. So
yeah, I don't want to give you your IP. No, don't worry about that. So.
But I'll give you an indication. How to find out a gap in capacity, if you like. The closing of it takes a little bit of thought about how to do that. But if it's the simplest thing in the world to do, and everybody kicks themselves when I show them how to do it, right? Because like, oh my God, that's the easy. Yeah. So if you think about capacity like this, culture doesn't trump strategy for breakfast. You need them both.
Yeah.
Right. And back to the ideas thing. If the safety department come along and say, we've cracked it, we've got a just culture procedure that's based on the principle of blame fixes nothing. Okay. So we're going to train the whole organization in this procedure, and on we go, right? If you've got a vice president operations, the person running the whole company is like, I'm pretty sure blame fixes something. Right?
It does as an organizational, societal level. Absolutely.
Right. So we're now, so this is the easy way to illustrate that absolutes don't have wisdom.
Yeah.
And if I was to say to the ops person, I want you to rate the importance and value, two different metrics, right? On a scale of 1 to 5, importance and value of blame fixes nothing and our just culture procedure, right? It's going to say, I'm going to be polite. I'm going to give you a 2.
Yeah.
2 for both, right? The safety guy sitting there going, this is magic, right?
I'm going to give you five or four,
you know. So when you sit in the room and somebody, and you're sitting there going, right, this is magic. The other guy's sitting there going, you don't get it, right? You don't get that. And the other guy's going, no, I think you'll find it's you that doesn't get it. I just need to persuade you that I'm right. And it's like, I don't think you're right. So how much trust do you have in that relationship? And how does that lead to productivity, to engagement, to getting the results that procedure is designed to achieve? So you are, by definition, 2 or 3 boxes different. The ops VP is going to go around all of his leadership team and say, just don't do anything with that.
Yeah.
You're being undermined because you're 2-3 boxes different. Now, if you're 2 boxes different, you've either got a bit of silence or a little bit of conflict. But you've,
it's manageable. It's workable. Yeah.
You can try... get somewhere with that. If you're 1 box different, it's like, well, I don't quite see the world the way that you see it.
Yeah.
So let's have an alignment conversation. If you're both in the same box, right, then it's like, it doesn't matter whether you both agree that it's a terrible place to be or a great place
to be. Yeah, if you both think it's ones, that's great, because you're aligned. Yeah.
You're aligned. It's just like, yeah, that, I get you. I know where you're coming from. Let's just work out how to make it better.
Yeah.
So capacity.
That's cool.
When I go around organizations, I look for the conversations that are in absolutes and they're very far apart, and I decide not to fix those things because they're just fundamentally broken. They're just fundamental disconnects.
Yeah.
If I go around and I find there's an alignment on importance and or value, and sometimes there's alignment on value and not importance.
Yeah.
But then I can work on value, and the more value somebody gets out of it, guess what? It becomes more important. So
that's really cool. Yeah, I don't need to go any further. That's really cool. That's really cool. And So it's interesting. In the training sessions that I deliver, I force people to have binary outcomes. And so I'll ask people, was this a failure to follow procedure? Should they be punished? Should they be allowed to go back to work? Or and is this a system problem or an individual problem? And I only give them yes, no's. And what's really interesting is where you have a small number of people and say, this is an individual problem, not a system problem. You go, I don't want to speak to the system people. I want to find out why those people think it's an individual problem, because they've got some insights that I think everybody needs to understand. And so all I'm doing is, yeah, so that's a really cool way of doing it. And it's quite amusing at times, and it's invariably very senior people who pick the it's an individual problem. The rest of the people, the operators, the mid management go, yeah, this is a system problem.
See, I so here's a question, right? When I was a kid growing up, and I had a conversation with somebody that was big and powerful, one it terrified me. But I found that I was in the presence of somebody that was looking at me going, "How can we make you a better version of Andy Barker?" Right? Which is great, right? I love that. I sat with a bunch of people that all had a letter in front of their VP title, ages ago this was, and they were talking about them, not us, problems. And I asked them all, because I had this experience when I was in when my age started with a two in front of it, and I asked them, how old were you when you got your first chunk of responsibility? And invariably around the table, they were all in their mid-20s, right? Couple early, some late, most mid-20s. It's like, can you tell me the name of the person that gave you that chunk of responsibility? And they all had a story to tell, right? They all had a story about Jim or Brenda or Deborah or Joe or whatever it was. And what did you feel going into it? Terrified. But somebody had my back, right? Which, for me, leadership is air cover for candor, to give it a
Yes,
monetary term,
absolutely.
right?
Brilliant.
So, and they're there, everybody wants support, and everybody wants to be a better version of themselves and all that kind of stuff. And then I asked the question, please, can you tell me the names of the 20-somethings that you've given the same opportunity that you have? And I was met with silence. So I, that point you're making about leaders thinking, it's an individual problem, I think we've lost a lot of, we need to value people for who they are and what they bring. And we've got an obligation to ask the right sort of questions that are going to say, why do you think that? And how could you make that better? Right. And, this whole, I don't like blame. It's a first story thing. But once you figure out why, like in my own world, if somebody's not successful, there's nobody to blame but me. So therefore, what is it that I can learn about how it is that I can better support you? And there's maybe one story in 20 where I've like, no, I got that wrong. That one's on you, right? Very, very. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't really happen like that. But there's a huge gap, I think, in leaders pointing at individuals, not themselves.
And I find it very insightful for me is developing myself as a leader as well. So I'm loving the conversations that I get from the different people, because it's not just about the audience that's out there that's listening to this. It's also about me learning and developing. So thank you for sharing your wisdom, and sitting there going, right, how do I use that? So just sort of like to codify some of this stuff, have you got a book or a paper or a video that you'd recommend that people could, that I can stick in the show notes, that people can go and visit and sit there and go, that's a cool bit of wisdom that I can try and sort of distill into my own space. It can be more than one as well.
I mean, so I post stuff. So I have a look at that. Everybody's got a blog. So I called mine Free Guides in the hope that somebody would actually have a look at them
You
and
got
download
free
them.
guides for.
Free Guide. Yeah. So that's on the website. So we said earlier on, I did some of the people that sent me on a different track. There's a guy called Professor Paul Zak,
Okay.
and I first saw him because he did a TED talk in Edinburgh
Okay.
about finding the moral molecule, and he started talking about how dopamine works in your head, right? And he just kept going down that path, and I co-presented with him in June this year
Cool.
in Las Vegas, but he's written multiple books on trust. He works at a government level. He works at all sorts of different industry levels on employee experience. And when safety guys figure that out, we'll be in a different place. So Paul Zak would be a person. There's a lady called Julia Dar, who is an Australian person who did a TED talk on how to disagree productively
Okay.
and come up with better answers. And I learned so much from that. And there's a great book called Crucial Conversations. So you've got a couple of TED Talks, few books
Brilliant.
out of that. But I found them great things to look at.
Awesome. Andy, thank you very much for your time. I know you're a really busy guy, and your insights are really useful for me and for, I'm hoping, the audience that's out there. So thanks very much, and take care. Have a great weekend.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.